Last time we saw him confronting enemies brought shame on himself. That man named Peter. If we're going to learn about Jesus and be introduced to him in the Gospels, these four accounts that shine light on this singular man from four different angles so that we get a very full picture of him, we're thankful, too, that we can see ourselves at the very same time through someone like Peter. Turn in God's Word to John chapter 21. And in the Pew Bible, it is on page 1086. These cell phones are turned off or down, right? You know who you are. You people with really fancy ringtones, funny ringtones, show them off on another occasion. Okay, John chapter 21. And this is an appearance of Jesus raised from the dead. So, just as we are in the sort of annual traditional commemoration of these events after Easter, between Easter and Pentecost. After these things, if you recall from last week, we were in John chapter 20, where Jesus reveals himself to Thomas, who was not present on that first day of the resurrection, when he revealed himself to the other nine remaining apostles. After these things, Jesus manifested himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. You'd be more familiar with it as the Sea of Galilee. And he manifested himself in this way. Simon Peter and Thomas, called Didymus, the twin, and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee, it's James and John, and two others of his disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, "I'm going fishing." They said to him, "We'll also come with you." They went out and got into the boat, and that night they caught nothing. But when the day was now breaking, in other words, right at the very break of dawn, Jesus stood on the beach, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. So Jesus said to them, well, I want to give this a decent translation. "Hey, guys, didn't catch anything to eat, did you?" They answered him, "No." And he said to them, "Cast the net on the right-hand side of the boat, and you'll find a catch." So they cast, and then they were not able to haul it in because of the great number of fish. Therefore, that disciple whom Jesus loved, it's the author's way of identifying himself, John, said to Peter, "It's the Lord." So when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put his outer garment on, for he was stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. But the other disciples came in the little boat, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards away, dragging the net full of fish. So when they got out on the land, they saw a charcoal fire already laid out, and fish placed on it, and bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish which you have now caught." Simon Peter went up and drew the net to land, full of large fish, 153. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." None of the disciples ventured to question him, "Who are you?" knowing that it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and the fish likewise. This is now the third time Jesus was manifested to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. So when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, by the way, just let me pause here. Sometimes we're too proper in our English, including translators. See those little asterisks at said? He's using the present tense. So to be all proper, the translators use the past tense. But we talk this way in our natural conversation. So when they had finished breakfast, Jesus says to Simon Peter, you know, like you're telling a story, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He says to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He says to him, "Tend my lambs." He says to him again a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He says to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He says to him, "Shepherd my sheep." He says to him the third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus says to him, "Tend my sheep." We're only going to go that far this week. I have these delusional ambitions to cover an entire chapter, but you know how that goes sometimes. It's the sort of thing that all ties together, but, you know, we'll just untie it and keep it apart. But the scenario, the scene goes on and wraps up the gospel. So what we're doing here is we're spending with the disciples these 40 days, which is a significant number, not accidental. You can think of all kinds of 40-day periods in the Bible, or 40 years. 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, 1 year for each day, when the spies of the children of Israel were sent to check out the promised land and came back with their report, and the people did not have the faith to enter the promised land, and so they were subjected to wandering in the wilderness. 40 days of Moses on the mountaintop receiving the law, Mount Sinai. What else? 40 days of Elijah being alone, having fled as well on Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai. Lots of 40-day periods, and all of them having to do with a time of testing, a time of waiting. Jesus, most significantly in the Gospels, 40 days in the wilderness without food at the very commencement of his ministry as Messiah, being tested himself to see if he is going to be the new Adam or if he's just going to fall back into the old Adam and fall to temptation. So here we are, 40 days in which Jesus appears to his disciples. And last week, when he appears to Thomas, he intentionally comes to Thomas. These men are not necessarily seeking him out. He's coming to them, and he's revealing himself to them. And he says to Thomas, who was very skeptical, I mean, after all, how many people see people who were dead, not just dead, but, you know, mangled in torture and destroyed physically? Have you seen, a few days later, walking around alive? So we understand Thomas's skepticism. And Jesus says, "You see because you believe." And then he refers to us about the special blessing that we have. Not the blessing that, oh, we're better than Thomas was, we can pat ourselves on the back, but that special endowment from God that enables us to believe. Faith. You're not saved by your works, Paul says. You're saved by God's grace through faith, and even that's not of yourselves, it's the gift of God. That's the sense in which Jesus is saying, blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. So we have this relationship with these 40 days. They are enormously important. We would not be here without these 40 days, because that message had credibility that was preached by the disciples when they went out and said, not just nice things like, hey, God loves you, and whatever you've done, you can be forgiven, and you're going to live forever, but grounding those very nice, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if these things were true statements in history? We saw it. We saw Jesus. We heard and saw his miracles. We heard him preach with authority. We saw him obedient. We saw him crucified. We saw him risen. So when we tell you God has put away your sin, believe, embrace a whole new life reconciled to God that will not end, it's based on what was established here with these eyewitnesses over a course of 40 days. So that's why we're going to spend 40 days here with the disciples. And this time, he meets them up in Galilee. So the crucifixion took place just outside the city wall of Jerusalem. Here we are 120 miles to the north. Something interesting in the four Gospels, you know, we're invited not just to read each Gospel in its own merits and its own as a piece of literature, but four put together, we get this composite picture of the story behind the writing of these stories, what actually took place. And when we put it together, we see Jesus both saying to the disciples, now stay in Jerusalem until you receive the Holy Spirit, but also go up and meet me in Galilee. Go ahead, I'm going to meet you there. So these men, over the course of these 40 days, and you can think about starting last week, 40 days, and what your plans are, but do you have plans to walk 240 miles? I mean, that's what Jesus is saying essentially to you. Okay, go and meet me in Albany. And you don't have a car, and you don't have a horse, you have to walk. And then come back to Syracuse and wait. Okay, so that's pretty ambitious, we would say, isn't it? These men did this all the time. I mean, we read the gospel and they are walking all over the place. So we understand that you're like walking with the Lord or your Christian walk or following Jesus. Of course, these are metaphors for a lifestyle. You can stay in one room and still be a disciple. That's, you know, the way God calls you to be. You can be in a wheelchair, whatever. But for these disciples, there was a physical dimension to their discipleship. And these guys weren't lazy. Just saying. I mean, for me, it's wow. So, they go up to Galilee, and what do? They're supposed to meet Jesus. And Peter says, well, I'm going to run down and get some notes that I wrote down. They're not there. They're all here, friends. Don't worry about it. No worries. No worries. I'm not panicking. Oh, there. Peter says, let's go fishing. So here are, how many, did you count the number of disciples that are doing this right now? Probably doesn't include Levi the tax collector, but it probably includes the majority of the disciples who were fishermen when they were called. What we have in this story then of Jesus appearing to the disciples is an intentional recapitulation, is a fancy word of saying like, this is echoing something. So when you heard me read these words and that miraculous catch of fish, maybe some of you were saying, oh, I remember this story. But wait a minute, I thought it was a little different than that. And what's going on, if you were a little confused, is there's not just one story like this. There's two. And it's not just a reduplication of the very same event. But there's enough details in both accounts where it's very clear these happened on two distinct occasions. And I think by putting these Gospels together and getting this full-rounded portrait of Jesus, we're supposed to remember what happened in Luke chapter 5, because there's a deliberate repetition of history here in John chapter 21 that's supposed to, like, you know, we use the term throwback, right? Throwback Thursday, whatever. It's hard keeping up with all these terms, but I'm doing all right. So, yeah, this is a throwback event where everything is orchestrated as though by one who is writing this material and is in complete control of the events. Do you notice that, by the way, in this story? And later on next week, we're going to discover, too, like, I have this plan for John. I have this plan for you, Peter. This is what's going to happen to you, Peter. Don't worry about what's going to happen to John. That's next week's sermon. Jesus has this whole story, this story too, your story, mapped out, under control. He's got it. He's got this. So, the message here that comes through very clearly in John comes through all the more powerfully when you step back and see the whole story, including the account of Luke, that there is a very deliberate, we are here back to the very beginning. You start in the beginning. It's a very good place to start. Right? Do, re, mi. So, this is a throwback to 3 years ago. Here we are at the Sea of Galilee, and what are these men doing? They are fishing. When's the last time we saw that? We've seen these men in a boat in Galilee during the course of their discipleship with Jesus, but they were not fishing. They were crossing the sea to minister. They were following Jesus, and they were doing exactly what he had them do. They were crossing the sea to get away from the crowds. They were crossing the sea to meet the crowds and so on. But here they are doing what they were doing the very first time they met Jesus. Right? Now, I've heard sermons on this passage that moralize too much. Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's like everything that you read in every story of the Bible, you have to say, well, that was a bad thing to do, that was a good thing to do. And that's one way of reading the Bible, but it's not necessarily the way that we're supposed to read the Bible all the time. And you can't just put stuff in there that's not there. So I've heard preachers accuse Peter, oh, he's reverted back to the old lifestyle, and he's going fishing, and he's not supposed to do that. Well, if he was doing something wrong, it's very odd for Jesus to enable him to do it very productively. Right? And miraculously sort of be an enabler of Peter and give him a great catch of fish. If Jesus' whole intent was to say, Peter, you shouldn't be fishing. Remember, you dropped your nets to follow me. Well, what was Peter to do? The instructions were, along with all the disciples, no one protested this idea of fishing, was to wait. They would be empowered to fulfill the commission of Jesus. But they've got time on their hands now, and what are they going to do? And people here in this story all act in character, completely consistent character. And Peter is not one to sit around on his hands and do nothing. So you have this wonderful consistency of character with Peter and with John, the writer of the gospel, who never identifies himself by name. In fact, when he's referring to himself and his brother James, he says the sons of Zebedee. And when he's referring to just himself, he's always referring to the disciple whom Jesus loved. That's how he saw himself. He's in character too. So, before the mists have completely dissipated and been burned off by the sun, when the dawn is just breaking, there's this guy, they're 100 yards from him, he's on the shore, and he's shouting instructions to them, and perhaps he's a fisherman who knows what's going on, but when the miracle occurs, it's John who, in character, discerns the person. Now that's his life's calling. That's his nature, his personality, and that is what is redeemed. So that what we have in the Bible from John is what we have. And it's all about who Jesus is. His gospel. In the beginning was the Word. And here is the big context of who Jesus is. Before we get into the details that reveal that. And then later on, John lives a long life. And one of the purposes that Jesus keeps him around for is that he's going to take on heresies that undermine the identity of Jesus. That he's the Son of God, come in the flesh. That's John's job. So here he says, that's the Lord. In character. And Peter, in character, does what? Jumps into the water. Puts on his coat first. He was well raised. You might think that's kind of odd. If you're going to get wet, you take off your clothes, right? And you jump in your togs. But Peter was stripped for work. You know, a fisherman doesn't get all wrapped up. He's doing some grueling work. They spent all night working, so he's stripped. And he was trained by his parents as a good young Jewish boy that you never greet people without a shirt on, right? So you put your cloak on and you go and greet people. And so just second nature, he throws his coat on and jumps into the water. And Peter acts before thinking. So, in character. And that's redeemable too. Everything here is set up to communicate something beautiful. That the way Jesus comes is not just, here I am, to prove in sort of some scientifically undeniable fashion that I have indeed risen from the dead, which does occur, yes, but Jesus comes not just in his resurrected body, but in what he is, in his calling, in grace, in the gospel. He comes as good news. He comes here as good news. Where is Jesus? Where two or three gather in his name, he says, there I am. Do you have John's gift of discerning the presence of the Lord? And do you have Peter's gift of responding to that with unbridled enthusiasm? God give us those gifts. And he comes to start over again with a man who needs a new beginning. So in Luke chapter 5, do you remember the story of the miraculous catch of fish? In that occasion, Jesus is actually in the boat. And he's preaching, and he's using Simon Peter's boat, and they're off from shore, and then Jesus says, well, why don't we catch some fish while we're out here? And Peter, who's at that point called Simon, says, well, okay, but I'm the fisherman, you're the carpenter, and I've spent all night, and I haven't caught anything, and I know what I'm doing, but sure. And then the miracle occurs, and the nets begin to break. Interestingly, we're told specifically the net did not break on this occasion when Jesus is there present in his resurrected power. Something is happening here, and we can have this new confidence, perhaps. So 3 years earlier, Simon has this miracle occur when he is in the career of a fisherman and he's about to be called and Jesus is going to call him. And at the very moment when Simon realizes who he is, he sees himself in view of this miracle. Go away from me, Jesus. This is Luke chapter 5. This is what Simon says. Go away from me. I am a sinful man. I don't deserve such favor. Here you have taken me. I'm a fisherman and I caught nothing. And you have just filled my net to breaking with fish. And I'm not worthy. And it was, boom. That was the insight needed. Last week, when we had communion, I think I probably said what I say every time at the communion service, you know, you don't come to this table out of a sense of personal worthiness, but out of the conviction that Jesus is your worthiness and you yourself are unworthy. And that's where celebrating and enjoying the grace of God begins. So, it's at that very moment when Peter, the confident fisherman, Peter, whose confidence shows up again and again in the account, in a very foolish way at times, at the very moment where he says, I'm not worthy, Jesus says, boom, this is the whole point. I'm calling you, and I'm going to make you fishers of men, and I want you to follow me. And here, Peter has followed him for 3 years. It's been a bumpy path. And it's been disastrous. You know, it spun out of control at the very end, and it crashed. And that's what happened. So, Peter is going to get the call to preach the gospel, the good news of forgiveness. And Peter is not going to be one who gives the gospel sort of out of a position of superiority, but out of a position of need, as one who needs it. He's going to go to people who are not Christians, and he's going to share with them what God has done through Jesus Christ, that they they themselves might be converted and know the grace of God and believe in the forgiveness of their sins and trust Jesus and follow him. But understand that that message is not just for people who have never heard of Jesus or people who have never followed Jesus, but people who have followed Jesus and have screwed up. So we're all going to close our eyes now, and if that's you, you raise your hand. I'm just kidding. I don't do that usually, but you know, churches that do that. It's just God and you and me seeing who raises their hand. But, you know, I think probably we have one or two people here who are good Christians, but they've messed up and they need the gospel. As Christians, as people who have been designated, oh, not Simon, one who hears, but Peter, the rock on which I will build a church. As one who has, at one point, got it like nobody else. I know who you are. You are the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God. Yes! You are blessed. Flesh and blood did not reveal this to you. And as one who said, oh, no, no, no. Don't talk about dying, Jesus. To whom Jesus said, get behind me, Satan. Very bumpy road. And then, three times denying. And here, what does Jesus do? Well, first he gives them 153 fish. Let's not overlook the number of fish here. I mean, you get the symbolism, right? Of 153? No? Oh, man. Why are you so dull of mind? Simon, the word Simon in Greek, each letter has a numerical significance. And you put that together with the word fish, ichthys, in Greek, and each letter has a numerical significance. And you add all those numbers up, and you get 153. Isn't that beautiful? Or you add the numbers from 1 through 17 all together, and, you know, 10 commandments and 7 gifts of the Spirit, and you get 153. And clearly that's the message here. I'm glad that you discerned that. I'm glad that I didn't hear anyone go, oh, yeah. Oh, I got to write this down. I mean, Jeff, you can take me on about this, but I feel pretty good about this one. If there is symbolic significance to numbers, he's the man to ask. But I think he may agree with me here that the beauty of this number 153, the power of it is in the absence of any symbolic significance to it. What it says to us is John the fisherman, who always counted the catch, and wrote it down. John, the businessman, the record keeper, tells us there's a lot of fish. So it happened 3 years earlier. And it's happening like nothing happened in those intervening 3 years. And what we are being told is that the one in whom all things are made new is making things new. And when things were made new and the newness didn't stick, he comes back and he makes it new again, and he pushes that restart button, or whatever metaphor you want to use, even to Peter, the rock, the leader of the disciples, the one who has been in constant contact with Jesus for 3 years. And you can understand that 3 years ago when he first encountered Jesus, he would see his life of sin and said, oh, I'm not worthy. But 3 years of being a Christian, 3 years of at one point saying, everyone else might run away, but Jesus, I'm your man. I'm going to follow you. I'll die with you. No problem. Really. That's how strong a believer I am. Fail, right? Epic epic fail. So here's good news that somebody needs here. Jesus comes back to this man, and in his impulsiveness, he's put on his coat, he's jumped into the water. The others don't jump in. They say, we're in a boat, and we're just 100 yards away. We can just, you know, go in. And we've got these fish to drag, Peter. And you can just sort of see them rolling their eyes. There's Peter. And they have a meal. And Jesus already has something going. Already has food. But not the whole meal. The charcoal fire's burning. Where did he get the bread, the fish? Where does he get this stuff? Doesn't he need our help to get it? No, he already has it. In fact, he has it ready for us. When we have, trying to get it for ourselves, failed miserably. Does that make sense? There it is. So he doesn't need our help, but you know what? He invites our help. So he doesn't have a banquet, a feast laid out for them. It's not the feeding of the 5,000. It is a breakfast for the disciples. And he says, bring some of the fish that you caught too. And he doesn't say, but he could have said, the fish that you didn't catch until I told you to put the net on the other side of the boat. Right? So Jesus provides what's already made, and he provides what we do too, and he uses what we do that he provided in the first place in order for us to eat, right? And that's how Jesus works. And it's all amazing grace. And it's all significant. And it's all communicating this to a man who has just jumped out and he's swimming to shore. And I think with every stroke, what am I going to say to Jesus? And as he's dripping wet there, and he's watching his friends come in the boat thinking, oh yeah, I could have just stayed in the boat. And they're eating their meal. And this is an awkward meal. We get this feeling, don't we? That no one did. So who are you? Because they, in the morning mist, and who knows, maybe with a hood over his, shadowing his face, I don't know. But they didn't recognize Jesus until the miracle happened, and then John said, it's the Lord. And they go there, and he hasn't said, it's me, Jesus. And no one said, hey, Jesus. And they don't dare ask, but they do know. So you get the sense that it's a very awkward meal. And the silence is broken by Jesus, and he turns to Peter. And he, okay, here it is. This was going to happen, and now it's happening. And what does Peter expect is going to happen? And it's just about as awkward as it could possibly be. Because what does Jesus say? Simon, do you love me? You know, grace is not necessarily comfortable, but it is extremely gracious. So, Simon blew it, and he added to the fact that he blew it by boasting that he would never blow it. Close your eyes. Anybody in that boat? Go ahead. It's okay. This is a safe place. You can just... Can you hear Simon, his heart beating? Can you see the sweat? Can you feel the pain? The last time that he looked this man in the eye, the rooster had just crowed. And he just had denied knowing him. 3 times in a row. And he wept bitterly. And here's Jesus and he knew this was coming. He's ready. He's ready for the punishment. And Jesus says three times, one for each time that Peter denied knowing Jesus in the presence of strangers. He says this to the man who, from the get-go, says, he says to Peter, I'm going to make you fishers of men. And then at the very end, he's going to say, you know, I'm going to send you all over the place, and you're going to testify about me. You're going to tell people the good news of the gospel. You're going to preach this to people who aren't necessarily really receptive or excited to hear it, that they too are sinners, just like you are, and you need a Savior, and they do too, and you've got that good news, and it's going to take courage on your part. And you, how did you do? You said you were going to do great. What happened when you were, the last time you were standing around charcoal burning? There's only two places in the Bible where we read about a charcoal fire. They're both in the Gospel of John. Here, Jesus set it up, and it's the fire that Peter is with the others in the courtyard of the high priest while Jesus is inside on trial. And it's night at that point, which is, I think, maybe symbolically significant. And three people are looking at Peter. You are one of them, aren't you? And you know what he says. No, I don't know what you're talking about. I've never heard of the man. Here they are. It's a setup. It's a huge setup, isn't it? The charcoal fire. Oh, man, this is going to be awful. Can I do this? Do you love me? Yes. Do you love me? Yes. Do you love me? And we read that Peter was hurt, grieved, the third time. He doesn't believe me. And why should he believe me? And yet Jesus here is doing what? He is giving this man, who's going to preach the gospel, he still wants this guy. He still wants you. He still wants you. He not only wants to forgive you, like, it could be, okay, you're welcome back into the church. You will always have the letter L on your forehead. You are a loser. You will never, ever be given any responsibility again. Never. But you're allowed to be here because it's all about forgiveness. But I'm never going to trust you. Jesus doesn't say, just, Peter, I forgive you. Jesus says, Peter, I forgive you, and here's what I want you to do. Like I said 3 years ago, I want you to follow me. Go away from me. You don't want me, Lord. Yes, I do. I do want you. That's more powerful than simply saying, I forgive you. You're still a loser. I'd never trust you, but I forgive you. Do you see that? So, for this man, whose job is going to be to preach the gospel, he's going to go out there among strangers again, and he's not going to wait for them to say, are you one of them? He's going to say, I'm one of them. I'm a follower of Jesus, and here is the good news. You can be too, and you really should be, because here's what it's all about. And the first time that happened, he screwed up. So here, Peter is among friends. He's with not all the disciples, just this group of disciples, his fishermen, you know, someone who he didn't mind stripping down and getting to work with. And Jesus says, well, let's try this again. Do you love me? Three times. I am giving you the opportunity to affirm that you love me. This is so powerfully gracious. I mean, you could do it another way. Jesus could have done it another way. He could have said, Peter, you don't really love me. If you did, you wouldn't have denied knowing me. I was the one on trial. But he doesn't say that. I'm going to give you the opportunity to say yes. And the first time he says yes, Peter's response is, yeah, right. I mean, Jesus' response. It's not, yeah, right. Follow me. So it's restart. Starting all over again. And you see in this account a struggle. A struggle between the old and the new. The old way, the new way, right? There's Peter, and what is he doing? He says, well, we've got some time on our hands. We're supposed to meet Jesus at some point. He's not here. What do we do? He does what he feels he's competent to do, right? They probably could stand making a little money by fishing. And so he said, let's go fishing. Okay, let's go. We know how to do this. We don't have to sit around and wait for Jesus to tell us how to do what we've been doing for all of our adult lives. Probably what Daddy did and taught me how to do. And there they do. And here's the old man, right? Confident Peter. Self-confident Peter. I can do this all night. Not one fish. And then this stranger. Why don't you put the net on the other side of the boat? Don't you hate those people? No, they thought maybe it's a fish. Why not? We didn't catch anything. Who knows? And they do. So here's the old and the new, okay? I forgive you, but I don't want you to go back to the old way. I want you not to believe in yourself in that sense, you know, that we're always taught. Believe in yourselves, but believe in me. And insofar as I believe in you, then you believe in yourself, because I am going to direct you, guide you, empower you, provide for you. Do you trust me? I will do that. You can spend all night fishing, doing something you know, you think you know, how to do. And Jesus never was a fisherman, but he knows exactly where the fish are. The sun is just rising. The mist has not been burned away. It's not like Jesus there. There's some fish over there. No, he knows where the fish is. He has some ready for breakfast. So here, the old and the new. Okay. Jesus wants you back. Restart. Let's start all over again. But please, what have we learned? Right? What have we learned from our past? So, we're going to talk about the name Simon. And you remember Jesus gave Simon a new name? What was it? Peter. That's right. And it's a fascinating way in which the old name and the new name coexist. And here John, as the gospel writer, says, Jesus turned to Simon Peter, uses both names, and says, and what name does Jesus use? Jesus is the one who came up with the new name, Rocky, right? The one who's made of rock. But he doesn't use that term. He says, Simon, son of Jonah. So not even Peter, my disciple, my friend. No, but let's go back to your identity way before you knew me. Because this is a restart. Let's start all over again. Let's go back to Simon. Okay? Because you're not Peter yet. You are, but you're not, you see. Jesus sees what he's going to make of us, but we're not there yet. And we need to know both things, right? We need to know that we are new creations, but we also need to look in the mirror and see what is not consistent with that calling of what we are by God's grace in Jesus Christ. Does that make sense? So, Simon, son of Jonah. Old identity. Are you new? Are you Peter? Now, here's the really cool thing. That in Luke's gospel, the whole thing about Jesus saying, you're going to deny me three times. Jesus says, Simon, Simon. He repeats the name. Which is always in the Bible a way of getting attention and of expressing strong emotion, affection. Simon, Simon. Satan has asked to sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. and when you have returned, strengthen your brothers. So Jesus knew everything that was going to happen. And he talks to this man, whom he called Peter at one point, but he talks to this man who had just, in his very Peter way, rock way, thinking he was a rock in himself rather than by the gracious designation of Jesus, says, others may run, but I will stick with you. I will follow you. So Jesus says, Simon, Simon, you're going to deny me three times, basically, right? And then Peter responds by saying, no, 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 no. And then, oh boy. Let me make sure I get it right. Luke 22. It's the only time that Jesus calls Peter, Peter. Luke 22:34. So, Luke 22:31, that's where Jesus says, Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift you, but I've prayed for you. And verse 33, Simon says to him, Lord, with you I'm ready to go both to prison and to death. And Jesus said, I say to you, Peter, it's the only time Jesus calls, in recorded Gospels, calls this man by the name that he gave him. Okay, rock. Okay, tough guy. That's the sense that I get. That's what's behind this. He changes names. Simon, Simon, listen, old guy, weak guy, natural, in the flesh, not strong guy. You're going to screw up. No, no, no. I'm ready to go to prison. I'm ready to go to death. Okay, okay, tough guy. Okay, Peter. The rooster will not crow today until you've denied me three times that you know me. So we have in this account here of Jesus talking to Simon, son of Jonah, who's just been doing what he's used to doing, feels competent in doing, and has miserably failed. Have any of you failed recently in doing what you thought you knew how to do? Anybody? It's so important. It's so important that we fail. Do you realize that? We don't appreciate that. We can be so worldly in this not really obvious sense in what constitutes success and in God's design what we need more than success. We so need failure. I'm not going to tell you to go out and intentionally fail. But I came to on Tuesday, not to pick on anybody, our beloved volunteers at Bible Club. And this time, that person shows up, that kid, who changes everything. Not in a good way. And at the very end of Bible Club, I've never seen such frazzled people. Right. The veins on their neck were popping. And, oh, my heart went out to them. Because it had been a disaster. Oh, by the way, you should volunteer for Bible Club. It's just great. you know, they didn't succeed in anything they had tried. And that's really great. So important. Have you miserably failed recently? Have you spent the whole night doing what you know how to do and come up with nothing? That's good. That's really important. Let's not go revert to Simon. Let's be Peter. And what made Peter a rock? Jesus calls him rock, not at some time at which he displays great courage, but when he recognizes that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. That's when he's a rock. That's when you're a rock. And here, I love this. I just did a Sean McNaughton. I love this. He's a wonderful, passionate guy. But I love this. Jesus says, do you love me? Doesn't just say that. Do you love me more than these? What's Jesus referring to? Some commentators say more than the fishing nets. No, that doesn't make any sense. Do you love me more than you love these guys, your buddy, your fishing buddies? That doesn't work either. But here's what works. Do you love me more than these other disciples love me? Wow, what a freighted question, right? Imagine Jesus asking you that. Do you love me more than anybody else in the church? What do you do with that question? Why would Jesus ask Peter that? Well, precisely because that's exactly what Peter said he did. So, Peter, when you said, I mean, Jesus could have easily have said this. When you said, everyone else may run away and abandon you, but I will not. Because I love you more than anybody here. Do you love me more than these? Here is the struggle of the old and the new. And the old Peter would have said, yes, Lord, I love you more than anybody else. But the new Peter drops the comparison completely in the answer to the questions. Yes, Lord, I love you. Period. That's so wonderful, isn't it? So let's leave this study here with this question and answer, this dialogue with Jesus. And he asks us the very same thing, does he not? He comes to us when we have failed miserably, morally, when we have denied him over and over again. And then we try to derive some sort of sense of meaningfulness, usefulness, by doing what we're able to do when we fail at it, and boom, there he is in his grace, miraculously providing for us. And that's when he asks us, not in a passive-aggressive way, not to find out information that he doesn't already know, like we ask questions, but so that we can look at ourselves. And that's what he wants. And so, he doesn't say, you do love me, but not enough. He says, I'm going to leave you with a question. Jesus was famous for his questions because he wants us to think. And he wants us to know ourselves as well as him. So he asks, do you love me? Peter's hurt. The third time, Peter's response, it's wonderful. Here is the new man. He is humbled. He's not cocky anymore. But he's sincere. And he says, you know, Jesus, I'm not going to argue with you. You know whether I love you or not. You know everything. I'm not going to try to, like, pretend I'm something I'm not. I'm done with that. Jesus asks you, Jesus asks me, do you love me? Everything is forgiven. Let's start again, but let's make sure this is intact. Do you love me? And Jesus says that as he comes to us with everything, shouting, screaming, I love you. Do you love me? And Peter says yes. Do you say yes? Go ahead. You don't have to be perfect to say yes. You don't even have to say yes, I love you more than he does or she. In my own flawed way. Yes. You know. Then Jesus says, here's what I want you to do. You take care of the sheep. This is the dynamic. Not come to church and find out what Jesus wants you to do, but first and foremost, make sure that we're not just running out casting nets, thinking we're going to catch fish, but we start at the beginning. And Jesus says to the church in Ephesus in Revelation chapter 2, I have this against you. You're a very great church. You're very busy. You're very active. You've got all these programs going, but I have this against you. And if you don't repent, I'm going to remove the candlestick. You have forgotten your first love. So, Let's clear away all the performance where we think we've succeeded, where we know we've failed, and listen to Jesus ask this question so that we face ourselves. So this is where we start. It's a restart, and here's where we start. Do you love me? Here's what I want you to do with your love. You pay it forward. You love others. That's the ethic of the New Testament, isn't it? As I have loved you, so love one another. John, that's his theme in his gospel and his letters. If God has so loved us, that's how we ought to love one another. Jesus saying, I give you a new commandment that you love one another as I have loved you. So you start with my love, and then you ask yourselves, do you love me? Now, stop going and fishing in your own strength and confidence. Establish this. Do you love me? Do you embrace this gospel, this forgiveness for yourself? You're not going to preach it for anything of worth. I mean, God can use it in any way at all, but how is it going to benefit you if it's not your gospel, your good news? And you've internalized its message. And you know you're a screw up. And you know Jesus loves you. And you walk around with this question, do I love him? Do I love Jesus who died for me? And is calling me, follow me. So, if I do, that means I will love as he loved. And I'm not going to love as he loved if it doesn't start with and is founded on loving him. I mean, you know what happens to a church where we love each other based on how we feel about each other? Oh, that is ugly. Oh, that does not work. When we treat each other the way that we think one another deserves it. But if you love others here and in the world and in your life because you love Jesus, that works. That works. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for sending us Jesus, sending him to us. Sometimes in really awkward moments, and yet hearing him say, as he said to his disciples, don't be afraid. So thank you. Thank you that he will provide for us. Thank you that he loves us. Thank you that he wants a relationship with us where we can affirm, you know all things, you know that I love you. And Lord, help us to express that love in a way that reflects Jesus, in the love and care that we extend to one another. Lord, cause that word to just stimulate our thoughts and lead to action for your glory.